How's everybody doing today? Let's say it's the last day, second last session. Party's over. Everybody got their connects. I'm surprised we got this many people out. This is awesome. So my name is Jonathan Snook. I'm here to talk about CSS3. So as you can see, the session, CSS3 takes on the world. I'm going to step through sort of a little bit of history, a little bit of what we can do today, and a little bit of what we can do in the future. And really kind of compare stuff that we used to do with how we can do it with CSS. So I've got a little bit of a theme rolling through this, so hopefully you can recognize the theme. I'm going to start off old school, rollovers. So how many people remember this? So our old Dreamweaver swap image for doing rollovers. Had this little script that you have to put on your page. And then on top of that, we would have to do things like, well, we'd have this onload thing that it would automatically handle for us and all these sort of inline on mouse out and on mouse over things. Remember how many images we used to have to create? You'd have like a navigation of maybe 7 items. So you'd have 7 images plus 7 rollovers. And obviously that was kind of a maintenance nightmare. A lot of work to have to maintain that. But CSS thankfully came to the rescue. And we have something like this, where you know we've specified a background image, and then we use the hover pseudo class, whenever you moused over, to swap the image with something else. So we would see some performance issues with this, where it would actually have to load the image. So somebody came up with this brilliant idea of CSS sprites, so where we actually hold both states in the image, and then we just change the background position. So this is nice in that we only had to download one image instead of 2, or instead of 14. So we definitely saw a lot of performance advantages. The sites felt faster. So this is just an example of where we were able to eliminate a lot of JavaScript and a lot of inline code in order to create a little bit more interactivity on our sites. So let's step it up. Drop-down menus. Clients love drop-down menus. You know, despite how many times I've tried to convince them otherwise, we gotta have drop-down menus. Things gotta slide out, you know, move around. Gotta have some interactivity, but we also need to have every page of the site accessible from a menu. So there's a really good script called Ultimate Drop-Down Menu. I believe his name's James. Brother Cake is his sort of handle. Works for SitePoint, I believe. And he came up with this script. You know, it was accessible, so you could do keyboard navigation, completely JavaScript powered. How do we actually create this dropdown? Here's a snippet of code to configure a dropdown. This is a lot of code. I mean, you can see that we're setting a lot of sort of CSS properties as well in this. So it was kind of great that you know we had this kind of functionality, but it was extremely complicated in order to do this kind of stuff. So let's take a look at a more simple example. So we have our HTML, and in the HTML, you know, we've got a list item, and then within a particular list item, we have another menu of list items. jQuery came along, and we had a sense of being able to do some simpler type of drop-down menus, where when the moment you rolled over, you know, we could do this in a much smaller bit of JavaScript in order to create the navigation that we wanted. But what's nice is that we can actually use CSS to do the same thing. So we can actually apply the hover pseudo class to a list item. So the moment a user moves over that, it will actually then display the unordered list that exists within that. So again, here's just another example of where we've used CSS to replace a lot of JavaScript. We don't need to download a JavaScript library. We don't need to use pages worth of JavaScript in order to create our menus. We can actually get away with it by just using some CSS. So the next concept is the idea of dependent content. So what is dependent content? An FAQ is a really good example of that. So that's where you have a piece of content like a question, and it needs to link to its dependency, in this case, the answer. So we might have a list of questions up at the top. We've got our anchors, which link to ID'd elements further down the page. So again, using something like jQuery, you know, we could do something where we attach click handlers to the links, and then for there, it might go through and find whatever the active item is, and then remove that class, and then whatever it was that I clicked on, go to the ID of that element further down the page, and then add the class of active. Now, we do have a little bit of CSS here in that we have to toggle between display none and display block. And this is fairly succinct, which is also nice, except for the fact that we're downloading like a 35K library to hide and show some content. So going back to CSS, we can take advantage of the target pseudo class. So what the target pseudo class does is when we click and the URL actually changes to like pound A1, that's the target. And so if you match an element with that target, in this case, a div that happens to have an ID of A1, we can actually toggle whether it's displayed on or off. Here's another implementation or example of this. So I believe that URL, just because the L's can often look like I's, it's a bit.ly URL slash DL capital GN24. And it's the idea of doing a tab panel. So you've got a bunch of tabs, and you want to click on a tab, and then we want to show independent content. So I'm going to go through this little video. And you'll notice that as I click on each tab, it displays the content. And this is all done using CSS. There is no JavaScript involved in actually implementing this. So again, this is another example of where we've been able to eliminate a lot of JavaScript, be able to simplify our code in order to do a very simple link of dependent content. So here's another sort of more complicated example, and I think a more impressive example. So Leah Varum put together this slideshow on CSS3, and what was really cool is that she uses this target pseudo selector in order to change pages within the presentation. So if you keep your eye on the URL, you'll notice it goes from slide 4 to problem 1 images to slide 6. Anytime you hit the arrow, the keyboard selector would automatically move to the next ID. And as a result of moving to the next ID, it only uses CSS to change the slides. So there's some JavaScript to hook up to keyboard events, although it would be easy enough to simply have one slide link to the next, and anytime you clicked on a slide, you'd have an anchor send you to the next page, or maybe you have like a next arrow somewhere on the page. So we could actually go from slide to slide as long as it's linking to a target. So let's move on to something a little bit more complicated, form validation. Form validation, I think, is the bane of probably most web developers. You know, we've got client-side validation, server-side validation. It's kind of a complicated thing. But thankfully, there's a lot of new stuff coming down in CSS3 that gives us a lot of functionality, a lot of flexibility in actually doing form validation without any JavaScript. So let's take a look at an example. There's a plugin called the validation plugin for jQuery. And this allows you to use classes such as required or email, or in the second example, a URL. And this tells the plugin that it should expect certain kinds of things in each of these fields. And then with like one line of code, boom, validate. Well, one line of code except for the 35K library and however big the plugin is. But there's a lot of stuff in HTML5 and CSS3 that offers up this kind of capability where we can kind of avoid using any JavaScript. Of course, we should always do server-side validation. But there's this lovely A List Apart article called Forward-Thinking Form Validation. So again, the bit.ly URL, lowercase b, capital HN, lowercase s, 9, capital T. And in here, we have some extra information. We see min, max, max length. So in this case, I want to enter in a number. So let's say this was a postal code for a country that required a number between 1,000 and 8,000 that was only 4 digits long. Also, it's required. So the CSS3 UI module declares a bunch of pseudo classes, things like valid, invalid, required, optional, in range, out of range, read only, and read write. So as we saw in the HTML, you know, we have ranges, like between minimum and maximum. So what happens when it's outside of that range? Or what happens when it's inside that range? What happens when they've entered in an invalid piece of information? So here's some examples where we have different fields. You know, we have the normal sort of full name. When they click in the field, you'll notice it actually displays a little icon, in this case a little sort of warning thing that we haven't quite met the requirements when we fill it out. Once we've actually typed something in, the icon turns to a green check mark. But if I like skip past that and I haven't entered something in, then we get this like red box that says, you know, please enter a valid email address. And then once I've actually typed in something valid, it'll work. So here's a little demonstration of this. Again, no JavaScript required. Start typing in. We've got the green check mark. Move over to the next field. It gives us a warning. Hey, by the way, you got to enter in a valid email address. Type something in. Hey, look at this. The field's red. It's letting me know that I entered in the wrong information. I go back. I type in a correct email address. And boom, it gives me green. I did it right. So that's fantastic. So how do we do that? So in this setup, we have an input. In this case, we specify that it's an email address. So type equals email. So this is a new input type. One of the great things about this is that if a user is in a browser that doesn't support HTML5 input types like this, it'll just fall back to a regular text field. So they may not get the client-side validation using this approach, but of course we should always have our server-side validation. One new thing that I really like is placeholder. So we can actually define what kind of placeholder text should be in there. Again, we used to use JavaScript where when we click in the field, we'd have to remove a label or remove whatever the default content was. We can actually just use placeholder to define what the placeholder content should be for that field. And the browser will automatically handle, you know, when I click in the field, start typing in content. You know, we don't have to worry about, did I actually do that right? Am I remembering what the default data was? It handles that for us. And then in this case, we have this paragraph afterwards with two messages, the invalid message and the valid message. So in this case, we embed both on the page, and we're going to display one or the other depending on whether or not it meets the requirements. If you're interested in accessibility, these are hidden with display none so that it won't be read by a screen reader until it's actually displayed on the page. And then we do something like this where we do input focus, so when they've actually focused on a field, and then plus is the sibling selector. So the sibling selector, going back to this, is my input. The next element after that is the paragraph. So it is the sibling. So as a result of that, when I input into the focus, it says show that paragraph. And then after that, we say, well, okay, well, is my input that's in focus required or not? Is it valid or not? So in this case, I'm saying, well, if it's a required field and it's in focus and it's valid, then I'm going to hide the invalid message. And if it's the opposite, so if it's an invalid value, then I'm going to actually hide the valid message. So I'm kind of doing the opposite of what I need. So within the HTML, if you can kind of figure out how we're branching off, you know, we start at the input, I'm clicking, I'm focused, and if it's valid, it's displaying the paragraph, and then it's going into the child and saying hiding or showing the invalid or class, invalid or valid class elements. So that's pretty cool. Okay, let's go on to something a little bit sexier, animation. jQuery, and of course most JavaScript libraries have a lot of functions that allow us to do animation, things like show and hide, which by default do this kind of grow and collapse functionality. Toggle, which will toggle between show and hide. We can fade in, fade out, which fade toggle toggles those. And slide up, slide down. We can do jQuery animations where we can say, okay, animate from the top and left for 500 milliseconds, and when it's done, display an alert. A pretty common thing. This is how I think a lot of people probably handle their animations, especially using something like jQuery. We can do things like animating background images. This is a technique that I had come up with after reading an article on Elistapart. And there's a plugin for handling animating background position, because jQuery by default can only handle animating on a single value, but background positions are a little weird in that they take two values. Internet Explorer was really smart in that they actually separate background position into X and Y values, which is really cool. I believe WebKit was smart enough to jump on board. I think Firefox is the only one that doesn't, which is kind of annoying. So hopefully one day they'll catch up. And then so we can say, okay, the default value will specify what the default background position is, and then when we mouse over, we're going to stop any animations that happen to be going on, and then we're going to set a new animation. We're going to say, change the background position. Move it around. And then once we mouse out, we go back. So you can check out that URL, 3 lowercase l, f, j, capital U, A. And so in this example, you'll notice that the middle one is blue, and this is sort of the final state. What ends up happening is that it transitions from the green on the left to the blue on the right. And that little line that you see, it ends up moving across. So we get this kind of swipe effect. But we can do things like CSS transitions. So WebKit was the first browser to introduce this idea of CSS transitions. And it allows us to say, well, once we've changed a property, instead of just going from A to B, do it over a period of time. So we can set the duration. We can set the property that we should be animating on. And we can actually say transition property all, so any property that changes on an element, transition between them. And we can set what kind of timing function. You know, is it linear, so it's a constant rate of change? Or do we get this sort of ease in, ease out effect? Or just maybe ease out, or maybe ease in, so we can get this more fluid feel. And again, we're doing all this with CSS. So Mozilla, Firefox 4 supports transitions. Opera 11 supports transitions. And what was really cool is seeing that IE10 is going to be supporting transitions, which is awesome. So we have a shorthand property, so we can just do WebKit transition or MS transition and then say opacity, duration, and the easing function. So let's take a look at an example of that. So you'll notice in each of these examples, all I'm doing is I'm animating the background image. I'm using a transition, and I'm setting two values. The initial value, and when I do colon hover, I'm setting a new position on that. And so we can actually create some pretty interesting effects. I'll just do that again. So in the first one, the graphic has a sort of bubble effect so that as it comes in, the example that we saw before where the slide out. And then the fade ones is actually kind of interesting, where I actually take an image, and at the bottom of the image, it's green. At the top of the image, it's red. Or maybe it's a green or a darker green. And by moving quickly through this large gradient, we actually create that illusion of fading in and out between colors. So let's take a look at something like targeted content that we saw before, where we can actually say, well, I'm going to target a particular element, but now I want to transition the opacity. So instead of it just displaying or hiding the content, we can actually fade between those two values. There's the animated backgrounds that I demonstrated before. So in this case, we set our image that we want to fade. We set our initial background position, and we set our transition. I want it to take half a second to do my transition. And then when I hover over it, just set a new position. And the browser takes care of all that work for me. Again, I don't need to download a 35K library. And then the great fallback for this is that if a user doesn't have a browser that supports transitions, they still get the two states. They just don't see the smooth transition between the two. So this is just a lot of sort of nice details that we can add to a site without having to really go overboard. You know, the browsers that support it, we get some nice effects. For those that don't, we don't have to worry about it. We have things like CSS animations. So again, this is something that WebKit had come out with first. And what you can do is you define a set of keyframes. So at each point within a keyframe, we're not setting a duration at this point. We're just kind of setting these things like, okay, zero, whatever percentage of the animation. And then we can define what the duration is afterwards, which I'll just hop to so you can kind of see an example. Once we've actually created this animation keyframe, then we can actually refer to it in a WebKit animation. So WebKit animation, in this case, throb. I want to use that example I had from before. Set the duration. And in this case, I can say how many times should the animation run. It could run infinitely. So if you hover over, let's say, a button, and you want to create this like throb effect, imagine having a box shadow on a button that as you rolled over, it created this little throb effect so you knew that was the active item that you wanted to click on. So we can set these different things, like opacity. You know, I want to start at something that's a little bit transparent, come to fully opaque, and then back to transparent. And then we're setting the left value, in which case it would just kind of rotate back or slide back and forth. Maybe not the sexiest, but. So I'm going to do another little demo, which I think is oddly appropriate for where we are. Yay, we won. Awesome. I wish Vegas was always like that. So in this example, again, absolutely no JavaScript was used. We're only using CSS to create the interaction that we want. So what kind of stuff have I done? Well, I've got a sprite. So obviously for each individual pane that we see here, we have a sprite, which just has all the different shapes and whatnot that we have here. And then we use the animation to define, okay, that should just rotate and continue to rotate through. One of the interesting things here as well is that you can imagine, well, if I've got this image, how do we have this like kind of gradient up at the top, the gradient up at the bottom? Again, kind of using CSS3 gradients to create this sort of three-dimensional look on my spinner. So I have a single image in this whole thing, which is my sprite, and then I just repeat it. And then I just create a spin like this. So this just goes through and we'll say, okay, start and just continue to rotate. Take the entire length of the image and transition that up. And so I just say, okay, infinitely spin my my slot machine, just keep going. And then when I click on the link to actually play, it actually changes the target. It actually is linking to a particular slot machine, so when it actually comes into focus, it can then change and say, okay, well, get rid of the animation and now go to a transition. So it'll take whatever the current position is and then actually transition into a final location. So I'll just go back to the little demo. So the moment I click on that play button, it uses target and just uses a transition. So the transition will always stop at a certain point. And then you'll notice that the label on the button actually changes. It changes from play to reset. And if I click reset, it'll go back to play. And again, we're just using target to selectively display or hide content based on the target pseudo class. Okay, let's do a little bit of tag teaming here. So we can actually use something like a jQuery plugin for handling CSS transitions for us. So in this case, we want to use the power of CSS, let the browser handle the hard work for us, and then we can still take advantage of jQuery to do the animation. Kind of the nice things about something like this is that it can still fall back to using the jQuery animation for any browser that doesn't support it. So in browsers that do, you get to take advantage of that. And that can be advantageous in, for example, let's say mobile platforms, that if a mobile platform has support for certain features of animation, like how many people here have an iPad or iPhone? Pretty good crowd. So if we did something like this, then those devices would actually still take advantage of the CSS transitions and animations and would actually still do everything it needed to. That demo that I showed you will actually work on an iPad, which is pretty cool. There's this enhanced animate plugin. So sometimes we run into kind of performance issues with whether or not the browser will take advantage of hardware acceleration. Thankfully, IE9 and IE10 have really gone whole hog in including hardware acceleration for a lot of CSS because, you know, a lot of the stuff is actually pretty intensive. You know, when you've got a lot of box shadows, a lot of drop shadows, things like that that require the browser to figure out, well, okay, I've got like a semi-transparent item, what's behind it? If I'm scrolling the page, I got to constantly recalculate how to flatten everything in order to create everything smooth. WebKit kind of does it sometimes, so you have to force it into actually using hardware acceleration by taking advantage of something like translate X and Y values. Because transformations are hardware accelerated, but something like changing your left and width value are not. So this is an example where the plugin can allow you to use a technique that you're going to be more familiar with, like I'm taking this element and I want to move it over to the left. The plugin automatically handles whether or not it should force it into using something like translate to do the hardware acceleration. So we've taken a look at a lot of sort of JavaScript examples. Let's hop into a little bit more of an HTML example, layout. So way back in the day, we used to use tables for layout. How many people still do? I say there's no shame. You know what? CSS is unfortunately still rather limited in its ability to handle certain complex layouts. I have resorted from time to time to still using tables for layout. I will admit it. I work on a product. I work for Yahoo, and a lot of the work I've been doing over the past year was for Yahoo Mail. And there is one example left where we had to use a table for layout. Unfortunately, thankfully, we're starting to see things like being able to do display table. So display table is a way of, you know, we can still use our div-based layout, and then we can override it with some CSS. So we can say, you know, our content area that we have should use a table-based layout. Because we're doing it with CSS, the HTML semantics are still correct. And, you know, the nice thing about this is an IE8, this is an IE9. And we kind of get the feel of a table-based layout where, let's say, we want to, you know, have these equal height columns. We can do that with CSS now, you know, that we don't have to create these sort of faux columns where we create a background on a container that looks like we have these sort of columns that go all the way down. We will actually have columns that go all the way down. And so we can say the sidebar is a table cell with a width of 50, and then the other one will just take up however much room it is. So this is something that, you know, tables did really well. We still don't have things like call spans or row spans, but this comes pretty close. Something else that's pretty cool is this idea of flexbox. How many people heard that the IE10 is going to have flexbox? A few people. So, seeing the IE10 preview come out so quickly after IE9 was fantastic, and to see that flexbox, that they're working on this implementation, because this spec is still pretty flexible in the sense that it's constantly changing. Browser developers are still trying to figure out how should this work. And so, you know, the preview is a really good way of taking a peek and see, like, are we hitting the mark as far as how this spec should work? But it gives us a lot of flexibility. So in the first example, you can see, well, we've got two containers, and then when we specify the third container, we can actually say that container flexes to take up the rest of the space. But in the second example, if I say, you know, 2 and 3 should take up the rest of the space, then it'll divide the space between them. So again, we kind of get this feel like a table-based layout, but it's actually a lot more flexible to than table-based layouts, where we can specify that certain things should take certain percentages. So, if, you know, if flexbox 2 versus flexbox 1, then maybe it'll take twice as much space than something else. This URL here, html5rocks.com, has a bunch of examples and goes into some depth about using flexbox. And so we have, now this example here uses like the CSS3 way of defining flexbox. Unfortunately, all the implementations are all browser specific, so you're going to have to do display MSBox or MSFlexbox. We've got WebKit box, Moz box. So unfortunately, you're going to be kind of repeating yourself quite a bit right now until everybody agrees and we can get rid of all that. And then we can set, you know, the orientation, whether it's going to be a horizontal or vertical environment. And then we can say whether or not a particular element is going to be flexible within that system. So that's a very powerful system for when it comes to layout. One of the handy things about something like this is that depending on the environment you're running into, imagine maybe a couple years from now, IE10 on the Windows phone, where you don't necessarily have to worry about older browsers, and you've got this very definitive environment to work within. I think we're seeing that a lot right now with WebKit, where if you're developing for the iPad or the iPhone only, that we could actually take advantage of Flexbox right now and say, okay, well, I've got this area and I want to just take advantage of it, I can do that. If we're doing desktop application development using something like maybe Titanium or Adobe Air, although I don't really like Adobe Air anymore, where it used WebKit as its sole and only browser. I mean, you don't have to worry about cross-browser development anymore, and you're only dealing with one environment where you know that it supports it, that we can take advantage of Flexbox to actually create these sort of application-like interfaces. And we don't have to use things like position fixed or position absolute, and which can get a little bit more complicated. We can actually do some pretty cool stuff here. I'm really happy about this. Again, in IE10, the idea of grid layout. They've had this sort of draft specification. Unfortunately, there's been a lot of draft specifications. There's one called the template layout module. There's the grid layout. I even tried to come up with my own called matrix layout, which unfortunately nobody picked up. But I'm really happy to see that Microsoft is finally going to an advanced layout system, because we are still, to this day, very limited. Flexbox is okay, but it's still very limited in the kind of capabilities that it gives us. Whereas the grid layout actually allows us to create very complicated systems and be able to place items within the grid. Often with something like Flexbox, we can kind of break source order a little bit. With floating, we can kind of break the source order a little bit. So with like floating, we'd float left or float right. And so that was really the limitations of breaking out of source order. With Flexbox, we can kind of break out of it with, along the horizontal or vertical, and that we can specify what order. There's actually a box order where you can specify things like that. But the grid layout takes it to a whole new level. This is like the first implementation of a complex advanced layout system, which is fantastic. So I highly recommend, if you haven't already, download the IE10 preview and play with this. Because, they're looking for a lot of feedback right now. I want to dive into this and see what the limitations are and provide as much feedback as I can, because I would love to see this stuff get implemented, within like the next 2 years, that we can start using this. So here is an example of how to define that. So in this case, we're using the display property of MS Grid. So of course, it's prefixed because it's not finalized yet. And then we can specify grid columns. And so we can specify a number of values. In this case, we're creating two columns, the first one being 150 pixels wide, the second one being 200 pixels wide. And then if we have a column, we can specify how many rows or how many columns it is, and then how many it spans. So now we're starting to kind of go back to this table-based layout approach where things can actually span multiple columns or multiple rows, which gives us a lot of flexibility when it comes to layout. And admittedly, I'm surprisingly pretty close to the end. So I want to thank you very much. I know there's hopefully a lot of questions. If not, hopefully we can chat afterwards. So you can reach me on Twitter at SnookCA. Thank you very much. So if you have any questions, there's a mic there. There's a mic there. Hopefully I can help you out. Otherwise, enjoy the rest of your day. Yes. The mic on?
Okay. So this is just off a comment you made. As someone who's followed your tutorials on Adobe Air, to learn about using that. I was just wondering why you're moving away from it.
So one of the reasons why I've been moving away from Adobe Air is, and this is going to be more of a comment on Adobe itself. I feel that they haven't really supported the web developer. They've done very well to support Flash developers within that environment. If you are a Flash or Flex developer, Adobe Air, I'm sure, is fantastic. Unfortunately, the documentation for a JavaScript, HTML, and CSS developer is very limited. The other thing that I don't like is the fact that the WebKit engine is still being rendered within a Flash container. So we see a lot of idiosyncrasies with this, where keyboard handling is not necessarily up to par. Mouse handling isn't necessarily up to par. Text rendering is using the Flash text rendering. So what ends up happening is, we've seen this kind of talked about, where UIs have this uncanny valley, and users are surprisingly astute in recognizing when an application they know that it's not native. They know that it doesn't feel right. It's not responding right. And we see that a lot, especially on mobile devices, where they see that they're on a web page, but we try to make them feel like native apps, and like the animations aren't exactly the same. The flick stuff and everything that we try to implement just doesn't feel exactly the same, and users pick up on that. So I've been moving more towards Titanium, which kind of removes that Flash layer. It's essentially a browser within a container, but it looks and feels more like a native application because it's using the OS for rendering, which I think is fantastic. The only problem with Titanium is documentation and the fact that the Titanium folks have really been focused more on mobile than on desktop development. So it's kind of a toss-up between the two, but I've been gravitating more to Titanium for development.
Thanks.
For the grid versus the table, it seems like the syntax is pretty... It's somewhat similar. Would the main difference between the two, or the main benefit of a grid system versus a table, the fact that it looked like it could break the column if it needed to? It was just more like a guide rather than a container?
Yeah, that's absolutely one of the great examples of what we can do. Now, with that, we can kind of get away with that a little bit with tables for layout. So I'll give you a calendar. Now, a calendar, we have a table. It's actually a very appropriate example of where you'd use a table. Yes, it's being used for layout, but it's also being used for semantics. You've got weeks, you've got days of the week. That makes sense to use a table for that. But if, let's say, you were laying out an event onto that table, but it needs to span, let's say, 2-3 days, what you could actually do is then you put a container, like a div within that, and then position the element, and then set that to like 300 pixels wide or 300% wide so that it spans 3 days. So you can kind of get around those techniques where it's sort of the old traditional table-based layout. But what these new techniques give us is the ability to reduce the amount of HTML that we create. A lot of the stuff that I didn't kind of demonstrate, which is a lot of the more sexier things like box shadow and gradient support. What a lot of this stuff has done, multiple backgrounds, it's allowed us to streamline the amount of HTML that we actually need to do. You remember, like, you want to do rounded corners on an element. So you'd have maybe 4 divs inside of another div. So you'd have a div up in the top left, top right, bottom left, bottom right. And each one of those would have a different image in order to create that rounded box. And by using a lot of the CSS3, we can actually reduce that overhead where we are using a single image or maybe no images at all to actually create these rounded buttons with lovely gradients that look and feel like a native control. And so we reduce the HTML, we reduce images, the amount of requests we have to pull down the pipe. So to give you an example, again with Yahoo, we were having gone through the redesign process and moving to using CSS3 for a lot of our interface development. We reduced our initial payload by 30%.
Oh, that's nice.
So.
All right, thank you.
You're welcome.
I have a quick question. You were saying about the span of the, you can set it to a specific width. And my question is, when you set it to a specific width, when you resize your screen, then it really does stay, it doesn't really resize with the rest of the table. And if we decide to go ahead with the CSS layout. What about nested tables? Because a lot of layouts really do have nested tables.
So yeah, I'll go back to this example. So in this example here, what we end up getting into is sort of these sub-modules where you may have a column, and then within that column you've got another set of grids. You still have that capability within this system to say, okay, well, I've created sort of the master grid, and then within an element that is positioned within there, you can define that as its own grid, that you can have a number of elements laid out within that as well. And then likewise, you know, when we span, so you can see in the middle example where the item actually spans across two columns.
Right.
And so let's say this was a flexible layout where we actually want this to resize. As I resize my browser out or resize it down, these elements can move around. We may want to use something like media queries. And so with a media query, what that allows us to do is say, okay, well, once we've resized down maybe beyond a certain screen width, to create a new grid layout where we can start moving these elements around the page. It gives us the ability to create these more dynamic systems of saying, okay, you know, this is my grid. Lay out the elements as best you can within that grid. As great as tables were back in the day, they also had their limitations as far as like what happens when we need content to break outside of a container. So we can see here the word system breaks outside of its container, but it's not breaking the layout. Whereas with a table, if you had too much content, like a big long word, I remember, you know, working on sites where, you know, I've got this long sidebar and it's built on a CMS and the client happened to have this really long word like disestablishmentarianism that they wanted to put in the sidebar, and it broke the layout because it then pushed that table cell way too wide.
Right.
And so div-based layouts kind of help solve that by allowing content to overflow without breaking the layout. And grid layout follows very much in that line. So it retains the grid system, but we still have that flexibility to break out of it.
But when it overflows, would it layer? Because let's say system was your first word, right? Would it layer over the ultimate resource in grid systems?
We do run into that potential where, yeah, we could end up in a system, in a situation where certain words might overlap others, depending on how we want the container to work. So obviously that's going to come down to a design decision. If we know that that's going to be too big and we don't want content to overlap, maybe we have it take up more. Maybe we change how it handles overflow. So in this case, maybe we want overflow hidden or maybe overflow scroll in order to give us more flexibility in our interface. But that's always a design decision at the implementation.
Right, because then if you do an overflow scroll, then it's going to overflow down under articles. Then you have another layer underneath. That's another problem. Well, my last question is, if we can do nested, you know, with this layout, would the child have inheritance with the parent? Would it act the same as if you did have like nested tables?
Certain properties are going to be nested, but that's actually a really interesting question because you do run into the potential where because of the ability to place elements within the grid, that the HTML, or rather the CSS, no longer has that cascading or an inheritance factor. So where you might say, I want this container to have a font face of something, and normally every element within there will inherit that CSS property. We have the potential to sort of move things around the grid where you're not going to have that inheritance depending on how you define it. That may or may not give us more flexibility. It may increase the difficulty for troubleshooting, which I think is a great example of why now is a great time to, you know, pull out the IE10 preview, try it out, play with those kinds of scenarios, and let's see what happens so that we can provide feedback to Microsoft so we can get this thing nailed right. So when IE10 comes out and if it has grid layout finalized and in there, that we can get other browsers on board and get these things implemented.
Right, because based on the inheritance rule, that would all depend on which browser you're running on.
Yeah, absolutely.
Well, thank you.
You're welcome.
You briefly touched on media queries.
Yes.
I'm actually looking for more of a conceptual kind of best practice scenario. If you make media queries and you do what you said, where it's like as it gets smaller, all of a sudden you make a whole new layout. What is your recommendation in terms of, do you then go to another external style sheet and call that in an import. You build it into your main style sheet. I'm thinking size.
Yeah. So with media queries, so there's this idea that or concept called responsive web design that is a sort of a term that a gentleman by the name of Ethan Marcotte had coined. He wrote an article for A List Apart, which obviously I've mentioned a couple times. And the idea there is to use media queries for different layouts. But we do run into that situation where, like, if you've defined an image to appear in one particular layout but not any of the others, that image will still get downloaded because the browser downloads all those CSS files, downloads all the images that it thinks it needs so that if you, you know, resize your browser, it can display those changes immediately. So there are people that are looking at different situations where based on changes to the environment, using JavaScript to dynamically load content. So it's there's no silver bullet right now on that. I'm still not 100% sure where I stand on the responsive web design. I feel that most people that are using it are still essentially doing device-specific design. They're saying, hey, I've got a 320-pixel-wide interface, i.e. my iPhone, and I therefore want to create a style sheet, and I will design it and in such a way that it looks good on an iPhone versus I want it to look good at 320 pixels. And so they're not necessarily taking into consideration those kinds of issues. And, you know, who's to say that what users want, because you often hear complaints, and it's definitely a tough situation for designers to be in when it comes to how do I design a mobile site? Because a lot of users are like, I want the desktop experience. You know, I have the ability to flick around the page, I can move the page around, that I don't need you to be hiding all this content that I actually want to have access to. You know, I'm at home, I've got broadband access, I don't need you to limit the amount of content that I have because of bandwidth issues. And so we can't really always understand what the context is for users to really know how we should set up the mobile context. And so the idea of using media queries, we're still figuring this out. And right now, thankfully, we're seeing a lot of change. We're seeing a lot of innovation. And hopefully within the next year, we'll see some cool ideas come out of that.
Just give you a reference point. I actually ran into an odd situation when I was working on a site recently where the, because the argument is true, it's like who scales their browser window to 300 pixels, right?
Yeah.
That's pointless, but what I discovered was that a lot of people have widescreen monitors,
yes.
And they use that thing where they smack the two pages side by side, and then all of a sudden you're actually working with a window that's really narrow. And that is where I see an actual potential in media queries, more than the phone part of it, the half-screen part of it, because a lot of people are doing that now, running double browsers.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, users don't always run full screen, and I think that's not an expectation that we can realistically have. I will give you another, I think, good example of where media queries would be fantastic. And again, desktop applications based on or even mobile applications based on differing viewports. So like an iPad version where you've got a large tablet and they change the orientation. Well, maybe when I change the orientation, I want to use media queries to say, well, my width is now smaller. Don't show the sidebar. Instead, put it under a button so that when I click on the button, it actually shows that. That's a really good example of media queries. With a desktop application, maybe you have this sort of large portal view. And then as I resize down, elements move around. You know, if I've got this dashboard, then maybe I have the sidebar. And then as I move my application smaller and smaller, elements either move around or disappear completely to the point where maybe I have this application that is now, you know, this wide in the side of my page. If I was doing, let's say, an IM program, let's say I wanted to build Skype, since maybe Skype didn't do such a great job in their last version. That you could actually, you know, build this sort of dynamic interface where the moment you resize it out, so at the smallest, you just have a contact list. And as I resize it out, then I can start to see individual chat windows, you know, that I have the ability to actually use media queries to do that, where I can say, well, you know, once I've resized out, I can show or hide information selectively because of that, in which case I don't have the performance concerns about how much information I download. Or again, if I'm on an iPad version and I want to change my orientation, then I want to make sure that I have all those assets available. That, to me, again, is not a performance issue. When I want to just change that layout, I need to still have that information there so that when I click on a button and show that sidebar, I still need the CSS for that. It's just a matter of I want to tweak the layout just a little bit based on the context versus using media queries to target specific devices. That tends to, I think, create a lot more problems.
Thanks. Everyone follow this guy on Twitter. It's worth it.
Thank you. So that's all the questions. Thank you very much.